So yeah, we're gonna just go ahead and start now. My name is Dalia Jones. I am a program officer for Borealis for Philanthropy, for the Racial Equity and Journalism Fund. My past work involves working at NPR in Austin, as well as the Texas Observer as an environmental reporter, Black Arts and Culture, Southern culture writer, and then also the director of community engagement. Before we start, I just kind of want to say how much of an honor it is to be on this panel with these amazing community engagement journalists. We're not going to do this like in a traditional format. We are going to do more so, less of me asking questions and allowing more so the experts to kind of talk. So I did want to, you know, just kind of put that out there before we started. So I'll let our panelists introduce themselves and yeah, we can go from there.
Hi everybody, I'm Adela Mascow. I entered journalism 4 years ago from Community Engagement Lens and studied engagement journalism at CUNY, then went off to the City, a nonprofit museum in New York, and now I am at the Covering Climate Now, which is an organization that partners with newsrooms to support more impactful climate coverage. So I'm always thinking about how we can be supporting newsrooms in engagement reporting within the climate space.
Hi everyone, I'm Yvette Capera. I cover environmental justice issues for GRIS. I tend to focus on pollution and contamination. I came to environmental reporting through other meets. Previously I had covered criminal justice, did a lot of work in immigrant communities in Southern California, and had worked previously in a lot of newspapers focusing on local news coverage. So much of my work today, even though it's got a national scope to it, is very much focused on what's happening in our cities and towns. And I'm also a founding member of the EFFORT Project.
Hey y'all, I'm Carly Berlin, and I'm a reporter for New Orleans Public Radio. I'm mostly going to be talking about some community engagement work I was doing in my previous role at Southerly, where I was the Gulf Coast correspondent for the last couple of years. Primarily reporting on hurricane recovery across South Louisiana in 2020 and 2021.
Cool, let's get started. So I want to ask, again, Southern Arts and Culture writer. So I want to ask a lot of pop culture questions, and I guess if you have one song to kind of describe how you feel about, you know, community engagement, about, you know, environmental work, climate justice work, all the things. What would be your first, I mean, your song? Kind of words?
Yeah.
Okay. mine would be Love Drop by Beyonce.
Oh.
Yeah. Mine would be Love Drop. I mean, for environmental reasons, right? But also, I think about the community engagement aspect too. Like, if you've seen, like, the video, like, she's holding hands with other Black women, right? It's about community togetherness. So, yeah, I'll look at that.
I'm not
landing
on one.
Sorry.
No, okay. No, this one's easy for me because I'm actually preparing for a plenary and I chose the song to play before we start. And I landed on Respect by Aretha Franklin because it's something I think about often with the communities that I cover, in that for decades, they have been working to try to bring attention to the issues of pollution in their neighborhoods. They're often not heard. They try to advocate for better policies, more stringent regulations. Nothing changes much. And so one of the things I try to do with my reporting is, one, you know, bring their, of course, stories to the forefront, their narratives, but also to make sure, you know, that I characterize their work as being active in this space, because they don't just sit back and take what comes at them, they fight it. And so a lot of that often comes back to respecting that narrative and making sure that that comes out in the stories that I write.
Yeah, I can't think of one for sure, but I'm thinking of Sade and many Sade songs, because for me it's about, like, really actual intimate relationships with folks that are created and nurtured
long term. Oh,
that's a good song. One of my favorite bands in New Orleans is called Sweet Crude, and they sing mostly in Cajun French, and think of these, like, really great, really fun kind of, like, pop versions of traditional Cajun songs. And I think of kind of their ethos and community engagement work because they're, like, honoring traditions in traditional ways that people have, you know, been with each other, communicated with each other, and then, like, also innovating on top of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very cool.
Oh, sorry. Wow, the moderator is not. So sorry. Delete that part from the tape. Okay, yeah, so, like, let's jump into it. I guess kind of my first question is, what grounds you in this work? And I guess kind of what are the barriers in newsrooms to do this work a little bit better right now?
Yeah, I mean, I what grounds me in the work is that, like, I've seen the impact of the work in my own life. And how news has served me personally, and as well as how the feedback loop ends up creating more sustainable journalism as well for a newsroom. But there are a lot of barriers, I think. And I think for me, that's like where I sit now in my role, is figuring out what those barriers are in newsrooms and how we can get beyond them. I think number one, one of the major barrier, I think, is like ideological at first. It's like figuring out what this work even really looks like. And how to incorporate it in a newsroom, because it can feel really big and overwhelming sometimes. And then, like, trying to get buy-in beyond doing it on your own, doing it with the team, and then getting the whole newsroom incorporated in the work are, like, major steps to get through. And I'd love to get more into that, but
Well, that kind of also makes me think, and anybody on the panel can see this, you know, when we talk about community engagement reporting, you know, what is it? Because it looks very different, you know. The different communities, and Carly, I'm particularly very interested in your take on this too.
Yeah, so I have kind of a couple different examples to share. So I think the two sort of grounding principles that I think about when it comes to community engagement reporting is, one, thinking about, you know, what information or stories do people need/want, and two, how do you deliver those to people? And so the sort of two different examples I'm thinking about from my work at Southerly are, we did a series of stories looking at how communities in southwest Louisiana were recovering from Hurricanes Laura and Delta in 2020. We had some funding from the Pulitzer Center to help us pull off this three-part series, and we asked for some funding from them to do a community engagement project that would be kind of incorporated into that work. And what we ended up doing was creating this printed mental health resource guide, and I have some of them if folks want to see them afterward. But basically, over the course of the 6 months that I spent reporting out there, I was hearing people say again and again that, you know, pretty obviously going through two major hurricanes during the pandemic takes a really major toll on one's mental health. I was hearing that especially from teachers who were kind of, you know, displaced from their homes. Teaching students were also displaced from their homes and were often kind of the first responders for their students' mental health. And, you know, hearing stories like that from a lot of different kinds of folks in that community. And with just a little bit of digging, it became pretty clear that there was very little information about where to access mental health care after these storms. You know, existing clinics were closed for months because their buildings were damaged, some had moved to a different place or had a different phone number, didn't even have a phone number listed. So even with just a little bit of calling around, it became pretty clear that it would be, if you were a person there seeking affordable mental health care, it would be very hard to figure out where to go. And I was hearing from folks that, like, of course, not everyone has access to the internet to be doing that work or making those phone calls to figure that out or even have the time to do that. So we decided to create this printed guide, working really closely with an affordable mental health clinic at a university there, McNeese State University. So we kind of developed this alongside them. And I then went and distributed these copies in June all across Lake Charles. And so that was one example of kind of like putting a finger on a need in this community that we really kind of learned about over the course of the reporting and then wanted to kind of like give something very tangible back to folks later. And the main point person we worked with at the clinic was so appreciative, particularly because you know, when I went to give these to him, he was like, we go through so many different funders to, like, try to pull off anything, and it's actually very hard to just get printed materials out there. Mm-hmm. And so it felt, you know, in that moment, I was like, oh, this feels like a really, really useful thing for them and for people in this community to just be able to, like, hold in their hands.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of capacity, right? Because I'm thinking about capacity internally, and I'm also thinking about community capacity externally, because a lot of these neighborhoods and communities that you interact with, right, don't necessarily have the time, right, to, you know, do a day-to-day, or, like, to, you know, maybe go to the courthouse to, like, you know, protest. And so, Yvette, I'm particularly interested in your take, because I know that you, I don't, correct me if I'm mistaken, but you entered into this kind of field, you know, from the point of view of, like, folks that they ain't got time, or, like, you know, you have to translate information, or people were working, and I'm very curious about your take on that.
Yeah, the story that I was working on that led to my work on the environmental beat was a piece on undocumented minors that were being referred by probation departments to immigration authorities in violation of this state law in California. And in the process of doing that story, I really saw how these moms were struggling to address their son's behavioral issues in school and outside and in the community. And the one takeaway that I got from all the interviews I was doing across Southern California is how much these moms love their sons. Mm-hmm. And they were frustrated because they wanted to help them but couldn't. And I saw a theme as I was talking to them, which was that a lot of them had ADHD, which led me to ask questions around what in the environment am I not considering as I write about these criminal justice issues, because I was writing about the poverty in their neighborhoods, I was writing about the over-policing, those kinds of challenges, but I wasn't writing about the ecological environment. Mm-hmm. And so I took a look around and started, you know, asking, you know, could it be something in their soil? And so, you know, when you asked about, like, you know, what keeps us grounded, it's definitely the people themselves, mm-hmm. because I know, you know, these immigrant moms are very busy, sometimes working two jobs, but they care about pollution in their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They just don't have time to go test the soil like I was able to do it. And so part of the work that I do is hearing what the issues that, you know, they've been bringing forth, like, for decades, and trying to find evidence or confirmation of what they're concerned about. And so that's what my lead contamination work was about, is saying, you know, here, I'm going to test the soil, I'm going to try to answer these questions, and then provide that information to the community so they can take that information and run with it, which they did. They organized, there's a coalition now of residents and activists and University of California Irvine scholars who have done great work around raising awareness, testing the soil themselves, and they are now asking more questions around, you know, what are the sources of this. But that takes time, mm-hmm. it takes resources. I had to apply for a lot of grants and fellowships to support this work. And it also takes time spent in the community to earn that trust with residents. And that meant for me, like, going when I didn't have to go, like, to the community fair, just to hang out in these neighborhoods, to reach that comfort level with the moms so that they could open up and tell me their stories. And so, you know, we don't get paid to do that. You know, mm-hmm. we just do it so that we can reach that level to get that trust that you have to earn over time.
Yeah, and I love how you mentioned, like, we don't get paid for a lot of this extra work, a lot of this extra labor, right? And I'm thinking about equity within the newsroom. I'm thinking about how, in many cases, a lot of folks who understand how to come at these communities also understand the amount of time and investment needed, the amount of emotional investment needed, right? Yeah, and I'm curious if y'all have any questions for each other around how do you get around, like, barriers or anything in the newsroom. Yeah, so I'm like, there's a lot of barriers.
There is a lot of barriers. Yeah. And I also, just from both of your shares, it makes me think about how y'all have, like, kind of broken open the idea of what journalism looks like, right? Because throughout your process, Yvette and yours, Carly, like, there wasn't necessarily a story right away that was reported on, and maybe providing this information to the community in the form of, like, soil samples and what came up from them, or providing mental health resources. And throughout the process, of the work that I've done too, sometimes the engagement is just replying to an email with a link to a resource, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not a story I wrote, but I wrote 15 emails to folks answering their questions, and like that, and that process is still reporting to me, still journalism to me. After maybe 6 months, there might be a story written about all of the work that was done, and that's great to show it. Also, you might provide a resource about how you did the work so that you're building capacity in the community for them to do it themselves. And so I think it's really helpful to like break open the idea of what journalism is, this process, so you don't get stuck in like, oh, am I doing anything? Mm-hmm. Am I reporting, you know? So just some insights that I was just thinking about while you were sharing.
I was gonna say, one of the barriers I faced early on with this lead contamination project is getting support through grants mm-hmm. when I was applying, you know, a lot of rejections. And then, this was in 2015, about like winter, spring time. And in the summer of 2015, the New York Times wrote a big magazine piece on Flint, what was happening in Flint. And it just opened up the floodgates. I felt like I was like hitting walls, trying to convince people that this issue should be covered. This issue around what are the impacts, especially on brown and black youth mm-hmm. in these neighborhoods that are lead contaminated. And so once Flint, you know, really got big, then I started getting approvals for this financial support. Because like I said, it takes time. I had to do this testing over multiple years. Mm-hmm. Part of it was started as a freelancer and done as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. Part of it was done as part of a newsroom. I really encourage all the journalists here to apply to these fellowships. Like I did get support later on through the McGraw School of Business, City University in New York, while I was freelancing for the second piece that just published for Grist. And it meant the world to me because it meant I could go down to Orange County. I was in Northern California at the time, driving back and forth. I couldn't just, you know, drive down from my home. I had to spend the night there. So it provided funding for, like, to stay in a hotel and food and all of that. And so I really do appreciate those types of grants and fellowships because they not only give you the resources to get out there, but they also provide training, like investigative reporters and editors provide boot camps for journalists of color as well. So I didn't know how to use Excel, and the data that was coming from the XRF analyzer that I was using to test the soil was being downloaded on Excel, so I needed to learn how to use Excel. I went through a boot camp through IRE to learn how to do that. So there are a lot of resources out there, including Uproot, which just launched a fellowship for environmental justice coverage, because we know how difficult those barriers are to overcome just to get the reporting done.
Yeah, and I'm also just thinking about how a lot of these grants are also tied to metrics, right? So like a lot of these grants are only like 1 year, right? You need multi-year grants again, like you said, the timeline is it's extended. And then essentially too, you have to prove to a grant maker that the reporting works. You know, and so I kind of think about that as a barrier, especially now that I'm in a funding space as well. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you had a question for like a funder, or if you could demand something from funders more so, what would it be? Like support for what? And I see you smiling. Have you thought about this question?
Yeah, I was just thinking about my experience at the city, and I think what was really powerful for us. And it's not always possible if you can't work in person with your community, mm-hmm. but we were able to. And so it was really exciting for us to invite the other journalists in our newsroom who weren't, in the engagement world yet, and invite them to these open newsrooms that we were doing, which were just like public meetings and libraries, really. And invite them there and have them with us, and then get them even more involved in like leading a little session in there. And then they started to understand the impact that was happening. I think, and then we also invited funders, that's why I was smiling. We invited funders to the meetings, and then they were able to see the work happening live. Because it's different to report on it back to funders versus them actually seeing the impact in the room and what's happening. Also, when you're a really small team, it's hard to like do the work and also share the work at the same time. So if you can invite people to be in the work with you and along the process, it alleviates some of that pressure to have to like report on what you're doing while you're doing it if you're a really small team.
So those are some of the things that for us was really helpful to get people involved and start like getting full newsroom participation in these major practices.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for the Pulitzer Center and how flexible they allowed us to be with the grant that we got to do this project. Yeah, I think, you know, they also have a whole kind of education and outreach department built in, and so they helped us organize a virtual community forum with folks I've interviewed for the stories, and we're kind of helping me get into classrooms in Lake Charles to talk to
students. It's that capacity building part.
You're not
only being given the money, but you're also being given the training and the access.
Exactly, and you know, that the sort of administrative logistics work was then on the Pulitzer Center staff helping us do that, and I would love to see more grant makers putting in that kind of dedication to their projects too.
Well, I'm going to do kind of like a slight pivot. I want y'all to ask each other questions. Again, I don't want this to be, you know, kind of like a traditional moderator panel. What bigger questions do y'all have around advice from each other too? I guess kind of my first question is your advice around taking care of yourself, or you're also, you know, embedded within a community and trying, and you're one person trying to help 50 living in the words of Beyonce Houston. But yeah, how do you take care of yourself while you're doing this work?
Yeah.
It's
really hard.
Well, what do you wish that you did more of? Yeah.
So I just finished a work residency at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center. And then, like, the third week, the sun came out, and it was beautiful there. And my husband, who was with me, was like, he had been going out on walks. And I was like, you know what? I need to, like, enjoy this moment, because I don't know if I'm ever going to get this opportunity again. Yeah. So we always talk about finding balance. It's really hard when you do this work, and especially like in environmental justice communities, you do not just go in and walk away from the story when you hit publish. You carry their burdens on your shoulders. And like, I stay up at night, you know, worrying about these, you know, issues that I write about. And so part of what I did when I was, you know, in, they had tennis courts. I was like, I haven't played since I was young. I was like, I'm going to try this. You know, my hips hurt afterwards, but I was like, this is, you know, this is good. This is just taking me out of my, like, journalism space into just breathing, which is what I think we don't, communities that we cover. And so you just, it, you know, these last 2 years with the pandemic has been one issue after another in the communities that we cover. And so you really do need to take time to recharge yourself in order to go out there and do the work that we do. So I don't know if the two of you have had that same experience too.
Yeah. I'll turn it off. Definitely. I'm thinking though also of ways of not like getting over ahead of yourself in this work. I think because for me, one of my mentors told me, like, just don't think you have to over-deliver to the community, because you don't want to get into a position where you just promise something that you can't follow through on. And that, for me, has been a learning, because that's the thing that stresses me out the most. And so learning that was really helpful. And also hearing from the community, like, just asking them directly, like, what do you need in this moment? What would be helpful to you? When a lot of times, they were happy to just talk. And share what's going on, and hear like, and feel like there was a sign, and hearing them, and responding with the resources that they could find, and that was enough. And I think that for me has been really helpful, to not think that we need to go above and beyond or work really, really quickly, because our industry can socialize us to think that that's what we need to do. And when you like gut check with the folks that you're actually serving, you realize it's not necessary all the time.
That's a question of like culture shift, right?
Yeah, I just want to echo that totally. I think I've definitely had to undergo a shift of just recognizing my own capacity and trusting that.
Yeah.
And, you know, also allowing myself to feel proud of the work that I've done and say, like, that is, I have contributed, that is enough, where I do all of the things. And I think that was harder after Hurricane Ida, where I also evacuated and was going through the reporting on it. And I think, you know, like, I'm going through this really hard thing and I need to rest and not be working all the time, because no one can do that.
I'm curious, too, from all y'all, what barriers you felt in doing this work, whether from...
Well, I was just going to say, I feel like the biggest barrier is, I think, of having people understand. And journalism allows us to have imagination, right, in the way that it's structured right now. So, yeah, I think that just buying in, right, because it takes a community to make change in the community, but it also takes a community of journalists within an organization to also make that shift. So, yeah.
I think one of the barriers I see people coming from a more traditional journalism background kind of talk about, and that I've also felt, is just opening the door between you as a reporter and your audience, and audience as like a community and not just your readership or listenership or whatever it may cover. I would really worry about kind of putting myself in a position where I would be like offering aid to people, like needing to draw the line between like, I am here to provide information, and a lot of time that is like sending someone a resource, because I would do that a lot. And I would worry about, like, is that, like, what is that line? Is that a line that I hear folks who haven't done this kind of reporting before be concerned about, you know, just totally throwing open the doors to, like, having this more reciprocal relationship. And I think some of the strongest reporting that I've done has been really leaning into that feedback loop, and I would totally encourage folks to do that too. Like, I can, you know, after Ida, basically what we did at Southerly was put out these calls for people to send us their questions for what, you know, what did they need to know about what FEMA and other groups were offering in terms of aid, and I just started populating a spreadsheet with those questions, and those questions then guided the reporting that I did, kind of like taking FEMA's word, what were they saying about what they were offering people, and then at the bottom of every story, there was a, you know, call out saying like, hey, if your experience differed from this, here's how you get in touch with us, and then those questions further propelled the reporting, and I think that allowed us to report things that I think really looking for information, and so that's part of the dynamic, but I think it, you know, even just seeing like how people framed the questions that they had helped me understand how I needed to frame the reporting and say, you know, one of the issues was around getting this like $500 critical needs assistance from FEMA that like Biden had come and talked about, and just knowing that people were saying like the $500 rather than critical needs assistance. No one was talking about it in those terms, but understanding the terms people were using and having, you know, also at that thing, COBRA helped me kind of like figure out how we needed to write a headline that would reach people about that thing. Anyway, now I'm rambling, but that feedback loop, I think, is really, really powerful to tap into.
And it's not rambling at all. I think, you're making so many great points. Because not only am I thinking about narrative shifts, but I'm also thinking about this from a movement journalism perspective. So movement journalism is a type of journalism, basically it's in service of liberation, right? It's grounded in Black Southern tradition and tactics, also with the understanding that a community is empowered when you put journalism in their hands. So how do you go to your city hall to, you know, talk to folks and officials? How do you do, you know, look for certain information? How do you start a newsletter in your community, right? So putting those tools in people's hands. And so I'm curious, also, like, on y'all's take on that, too. I feel like community engagement especially changed. Like, not only, like, you know, my perspective has changed, you know, for me in a community with movement journalists, but in community engagement, you have no choice but to interact, to see people's humanity, to understand what equity and oppression and marginalization is. And so I'm really, you know, curious on, like, I guess this is, like, a rambling question. I'm rambling. I'm just curious on, like, your take on that. We're supposed to have this all between us, right? Again, I always say it's a privilege to feel like you are untouched by an issue, right? And especially when we're talking about the community, not only telling their own stories, but also giving that power to other people as well to tell their own stories. And so, yeah.
One of the great things about being a journalist is that you do have a license to call experts across the country, community advocates, residents of lack of quality air pollution data, that, you know, communities have organized to gather their own data. And so when a resident in the city of Santana, which is where I did my lead contamination project, would tell me, we call the South Coast Air Quality District and they show up 2 hours later and we don't get reliable, you know, data when we're complaining about fumes from the local paint shop, I can think back to like the Bucket Brigade and mention, you know, this is the work that's being done here. And it's just part of the conversation. Like, it may not end up in the story, but just being exposed to the work that's happening at the community level means that you're essentially connected to that extractive journalism, which you're just parachuting into a community to write about that. You know, to avoid that, you, as like I was saying before, you have to establish those relationships and have those conversations and share that information, you know, because I believe that we're not just there as we, you know, interview them and learn from them. They're also learning as we interview them as well. So I think that's maybe one way, is just sharing the information that we have access to because we are journalists.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about also like sharing a past classmate at CUNY. Whenever you started an interview, you would ask the person who's interviewing what questions they had for him about his work and about what he was doing there and what would happen next piece. And a lot of, I think there's a kind of a, we as journalists think people know what journalism is.
And like how journalism
they
is.
Don't know.
A lot of people don't. And that's kind of where mistrust can come from, is that like that process isn't super transparent. And if you make it transparent, then there can be like some collaboration in the process when it's possible, and there can just be inherent trust built as well. Just what you were saying made me think about that.
Yeah, I think a shift that I've sort of undergone in the last few years is thinking about, you know, the figure of a journalist as like a person versus journalism as a set of tools.
Come on.
That anyone can use. Need special training, or you know, you can be talking about it like exactly the process that you're going through, and so then other people can tap into that in different ways.
Yeah. Y'all wanna, anybody have a question for Jim?
I have a question regarding the process, like once you publish a story and you don't like town hall story to publish and just sit there and have no impact. And so that's often why we hold these like town halls and these discussions. I'm wondering, like, as far as accessibility, like, you know, I write for Grist, it's an English language, they're so small, like there's a lack of resources to translate the piece, like translating a literary work from Italian. And so she was talking about like the, as she was speaking and presenting her work, I was thinking about how I you know, Grist's audience is very much on board with, you know, stopping global warming, but I often feel like we're preaching to the choir. You know, we don't need to, you know, it's
they're very smart people. For is more so the question, like,
yes,
yeah,
yes.
Who's your audience?
Yes, yeah. And so as I was hearing Juan Luis Goto, who's the translator that I'm talking about, as she was talking about, like, the many languages that she translated into, I mean, it just reminded me of how, like, she's basically giving a community access to this literary work that otherwise they would not have had access to, and how there's a whole global audience out there for our work, but I don't know if there's anyone already doing that work, because I do feel like the challenges of a lot of shared experiences at the global level, and so are there...
I've been thinking about that, too, because like translating it with its context and the cultural idioms and all that comes with that. So if anyone knows resources, let me know. I like from the like movement and social justice world, there's a lot of, and like I've been in public meetings where translators are there translating live for folks, which I think can be used for journalism meetings as well and should be. But yeah, still figuring out how we can share our journalism after the fact in other communities that have shared experiences. And if there's resources out there that can help with that.
Yeah. And I'm also thinking about accessibility beyond beyond language too, right? I'm thinking about folks who have disabilities. I'm thinking about folks who intervene on the border of Louisiana and Texas. And I remember just like a lot of the elders being like, can you teach us how to use Twitter? Can you teach us how to make a newsletter? Like, you know what I mean? So I'm also just thinking about access from that way as well. So I don't know if that...
There too, it made me think about the documenters program in Chicago and El Pantano in Oakland and others, where they're serving the community with the information that they need, but then also showing them how to get it themselves and share it within their own communities. And so I think that
if you can, it actually makes your job as a journalist easier in the long run. If you can at first do what you can to show the community with information and then figure out how to like duplicate that work for them to show them how it can be done, and how they can share that back with you and build capacity in the community for that. At the city, we were even thinking about, you know, when is it okay to like build capacity and have community members step in to do the work, but then not pay them? So then we were getting into that conversation around like, can journalism institutions pay community members to give them like essential information from meetings so that they can do the work more? And I think that is a really exciting space to start thinking about like beyond what journalism has been and how you can actually bring the community into the work you're doing.
And leaving more than you take.
Yeah, exactly.
And after this event, I'm going to do a pivot before we go into Q&A's.
Yeah, I was just going to add that that always make sure to look for online spaces that as a way to connect with and access communities, because I know during COVID, during the pandemic, I was covering the impacts on the farm worker community in California, and there was a group of farm workers in Oxnard that organized food who had phones. They were very savvy and were on Instagram telling their stories, like announcing the food drives on Facebook. And then a lot of the interviews I was doing was on WhatsApp with the farm workers, you know, when I couldn't do it in person. And so so I would say that, you know, especially if you're trying to access stories that are in communities that are, you know, in other states, and you don't have that ability to be there in person, to look for those spaces because they are there and they are using them to organize themselves. But it's a great way also to get the stories out, which they did. Like after our stories published, you know, I made sure to, you know, a post in my limited high school Spanish, you know, in Spanish on Instagram so that they can access that as well, even though the stories were in English.
That also just reminds me also of a lot of things that y'all, thank y'all. it just reminds me a lot about the importance of collaboration between newsrooms. I think that we're all competing, right? Or, you know, it used to be for me. I feel like a lot of the newsrooms that, you know, you work in, they're competing. And I think that we could really be solving a lot of these issues if we either went after funding together or, like, actually worked together, you know, especially if you're regional. How essential is this work to environmental reporting? It's also about what can get people into action, what informs a community to help them change. So how essential is this to that type of work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's essential to all journalism, so I don't really care what kind it is we're talking about.
Yeah.
But I think for climate especially, because I think that it can feel so existential and so big for communities when they're facing it, but then also when they're starting to try to access information about it, because a lot of the stories that are told are just so large in scope. It starts getting bigger, and like international policy, international problems, and so it can just start getting bigger and bigger. And I'm even thinking from my own experience in Northern California and reading about wildfires and about drought and about like this year we've only gotten 35% of the amount of water that we should have. Last year we got 65% at this time. So I was reading a story that was like that, and it was just left feeling horrible about it. And it made me think, like, what if that information was delivered to me in a different way, where, like, I can actually access the folks that in my area that I need to start thinking about how we can limit our water use together, to start thinking about how we can, appeal to the people in power where we are to like talk about maybe some dams that shouldn't be there so that we can access water more quickly. Like those are the things that came to mind for me about like how can we report on this in a community where it's serving them versus just giving them information about the issue at hand. And so
it sounds like hope.
And also like, you know, not like empty hope.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like I think there are some stories you in game of reporting you can give people like resources to take steps in their communities, and I think that's really grounding people even within a crisis. For me as well, reading about wildfires, like I want to know how to prepare myself for one, right? Like not to hear that there's another one on the horizon or that there's going to be horrible air pollution in my area for the next week, but like what are the steps I need to take to protect myself when that's happening? And so this is just the way that I think about engagement reporting being able to enable communities beyond understanding the crisis that they're facing, and all the complexities that are like regionally specific to them.
If you haven't had a chance to read this, I think a really great example of community engagement reporting is ProPublica's project on their toxic release inventory database. It essentially takes and shows and maps, you know, this emission data from a lot of reporters in those communities if they want to tap that database to do more of those types of stories. And I'm actually using it as a guide for my own guide on lead contamination. The other thing I would say is, that's crucial, I believe, because you are, like, it's a resource for both journalists and communities. The other thing I would say is important is to tap the experts that are in these fields already doing this work, which I did for my professor Scott Frickle from Brown, had done this great work of creating databases looking at these historical manufacturing businesses in cities across the United States, including Minneapolis and Portland, to look at the legacy contamination that exists and is not documented by federal environmental regulations. And so by setting the example, I essentially use their methodologies like that for journalists to tap, and that in turn becomes a resource for the community so that they understand that history, which I just did for one city, but I'm hoping to be able to create a guide to sort of go through that step-by-step process that I did to create this process so other journalists don't be presented very much like ProPublica did with their database. But it's a way of sort of helping the community understand that history that often gets buried, and accessing it for present day concerns that they may have around pollution and contamination.
Yeah, I would definitely echo both of those things, and I think, you know, coming from this sort of disaster view that I've carved out for myself over the last few years, I think I've really come to think about the work I'm doing as harm reduction. And, you know, I can't make these horrible major hurricanes go away, but I can help equip people with tools to, you know, make better and more informed decisions and, you know, help other folks kind of understand, feel a little bit more agency themselves with going through an existential crisis, too. All
right. Thank you so much. So now we're going to open it up to Q&A. So we're asking SEJ members to go first and to identify yourself when you do ask a question. But yeah, we can start.
Does the Express News provide access, sometimes if there's a disaster or a special series or stories, do they give access to those?
Important that has to do with water reporting. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed, if I write a story I think is important that has to do with water, I'll have to ask my editor to ask, another editor to, make sure that it's free for everyone to read. So it's really not as popular as I feel like it is for other news, newsrooms. I notice that sometimes it just doesn't show up. That they still have to pay for this immediate coverage. And that can be kind of frustrating. We do have a free website that's attached to the Express News, but not the free website. The free website would be events that are coming up this weekend.
I would say maybe there's an argument to be made or a discussion to be had around
public, what's considered like public service mm-hmm. journalism, which I consider like basically like anything health related, I think would fall under that category, environment, climate, because you are providing a public service, and oftentimes like the company that loaned me the equipment to test the soil loaned it to me for free, and they said, we're loaning it to you because we see this as a public service to the community. And so, absolutely, I'm, you know, very glad I was working for news organizations that were nonprofits and give free access to that information. But as we all know, it costs money to produce this work, which is the dilemma. How do we get paid to do this? But so that it's free to the community, I don't know if anyone else has any other idea.
Well, I was also going to say, one thing a mentor once told me was, like, it's a values question, too. Like, values that align with the organization that you're with. But I also just think about collaboration again. Like, is there a local, like, NPR station? Is there, like, a local community grassroots organization that wouldn't mind, like, actually republishing the piece for free? Could you also, like, what we did for media training is we made pamphlets that simplify. We placed them in church corner where you need to know to protect yourself. How did you, like, you know, so in 101, we placed them in churches and barbershops and, like, you know, places like that. That are accessible. So,
Yeah, I think off of that, there can be many versions of the thing that you produce from an engagement project. So maybe there is a version that's behind a paywall, and there's another version that's not, and that's in collaboration with another newsroom, or that is your own thing, but it's on the other website or in a material piece. But then I also think that there's definitely an argument to be made to take the paywall down, only the project. From the point of view of it being a public service, but then also from the point of view of it actually increasing subscriptions mm-hmm. to the publication in the end. And there's been evidence of that over and over again. And I've been thinking about how to create a resource for that from covering climate now, so you're making me think that it should be done more quickly.
And something I've thought about, well, like when I pitched this first to my editors, their first question was like, is this going to increase our subscriber mm-hmm. base? Mm-hmm. And I get what you're saying, but I guess that just takes a longer time because like, I feel like primary thing we're looking for is to build that trust first, yeah. and then they would be like, oh, I care enough to want to subscribe, not like going into these communities and being like, you should subscribe to our paper.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also not necessarily the folks, the communities that you're trying to serve that are the ones who subscribe. Sometimes it's other tertiary adjacent communities that see the work that you're doing that aren't in as direct need but want to support your publication because of the work you're doing, actually.
Okay.
Well, Carly, was the Advocate, like, were they the private, like, did they have a paywall for their publication?
Yeah, so they often would lift the paywall during, like, hurricane coverage, and I never worked there directly, but they would republish some of these stories. I was doing a republication in local outlets for free, and so we worked pretty closely with other outlets to just be, like, expanding or extending our, like, fairly limited reach.
Great question. Thank you.
I'm wondering if you've ever encountered this as you go out in your reporting, and that is like kind of being kind of upfront in a way where kind of it's like, what, yeah, I tell you this, no, nothing's going to happen, you know, nobody's going to care, like, I'm not fine for this, I go away, essentially. Like, how do you kind of overcome that experience and like encourage them, but also respect?
I feel like there was like a collective sigh a little bit.
California, because I have worked in immigrant communities, there is a segment of the population that's undocumented, and I up front will tell them it's a risk if you talk to me and we use your real name, because Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been known, you know, to go after people whose names are published in the media, and so. I was fortunate to have worked at numerous news organizations, you know, where the policy was pseudonym, so that they could still tell their story but not have their name published. So that's one way. But even then, I've had people say, I don't want to take that risk, and I completely respect that. It's not worth it for a story to have their entire livelihood put at risk and risk possible deportation. So I would work around that by looking for folks who, you know, could speak on their behalf, or like I said, using just a first name or a pseudonym to to allow them to tell that story, because we did, and I feel it's so important to have those voices in our stories. But another tactic that I've used or approach is, like I said, earning that trust by going back again and again. And like one little boy that I wrote about, I met him when he was 8, and when I finally wrote the story and featured him in my lead contamination series, he was 11. And so I had spent like a lot of time in that neighborhood covering different issues, including a gang injunction that was proposed by the district attorney. And so his mom and his family and Sessa, that way, were seeing me a lot in the neighborhood. I was talking to his mental health, to his mom, if I could cut the soil in the yard of her apartment complex. She was like, yeah, you know, sure. And then came the next step of like, okay, I found lead, you know, can we talk about possible implications for your family? And so over time going back, you know, she agreed to allow me to tell the story. And then I had to spend a lot of time with the family. So I would say when they say no, like if you go back to the neighborhood and they see you talking to other folks, that often helps too. Talking to other residents, talking to experts. There's often a connector. In this case, it was the mental health therapist that was working with Sessa, who was the sort of gateway to the family. And because they trusted her, they started to trust me. And then they finally trusted me over time as I built that relationship. So I would say it's not a given if someone says no. You know, there are other people around them that are likely working with them, social workers, teachers, other educators that can help open doors for you to try to work your way into that into that point where you can interview them.
Yeah, and I think too, I don't know, I haven't come across ever really putting in the time and work to get to know the community and them saying no after that was all done. I've come across people saying no, like when there isn't that much time spent at first, which I totally understand. And one of the things that I've learned to do as well is directly ask folks when you're getting to know them, what has the harm been done in this community with journalism? Where is it mistrust coming from? Like those are parts of conversations for me to get to know communities. And bringing that up, I think, allows people to feel super safe to talk about that stuff. And maybe to have a more nuanced response than just no when the time comes for that, right? Maybe it's like, yeah, but I'm not sure about this or this, and then it's not a full no. Trust is there, and the conversation hasn't been opened, and they're just going to block it from the beginning.
Yeah. So as somebody who's reporting on their own community, so I'm from Lufkin, but I have family in Nacogdoches, DC's Texas region. So like one thing I first learned is like, just because you run a region, don't mean that people trust you, for one. But once you get, again, access to like that one auntie in the neighborhood or that one like, you know, professor, you know, in the community, like it's a professor, but she also did a lot of community organizing. When I tell you, me and my colleague chased this woman down to the ends of the earth, we would call her, you know, it took us actually going back like dozens of times to the community to actually get access. So once we did, it like opened up the floodgates, right? So again, I think it's like going back and establishing that you're there for a long time, but also like identifying and being like, I see you, I understand, you know, my people are from, you know, Northside, so like they know exactly what you're going through, or my auntie, you know my uncle, right? So like also establishing those ties also helped too. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Yeah, that helps. Like I said, I was kind of wondering more about like people who are concerned that your reporting will have no impact. That's like what I'm talking about, where it's like there's no point in me doing it, nothing's going to happen once I share my story.
Do y'all find like in a community engagement event?
As their in-person event, yeah. But I think also the question that comes to mind for me is I'm wondering what's the impact they want to see.
Yeah.
Like that's what I would ask. And I know we're talking about like hypotheticals right now. We don't really know the community you're from or what their issues that they're dealing with. But that's what comes to mind for me is wanting to know. Oh, this is not on. is wanting to know what's the impact that they want to see. Like, is there a resource they really need in their community? Is it that they want external awareness of their issues that you can't do, but you can point them to? Like, yeah.
And then I think that it also goes in line with like knowing what journalism is too, and
right?
Being realistic about the expectations around journalism.
please tell me your story. The stories come rolling in, you get great stuff, you build. Do you guys have a good example story, and the call outs keep coming in? People keep telling you their stories and keep telling your things. Do you guys have good examples of either how to gracefully wrap that up if your news organization's done with that topic, or how to extend that in the follow ups? Have you seen good examples of people who are able to keep spinning that off, even if it's like the same story you just keep hearing?
I don't have a specific example that comes to mind. I'm thinking of my reaction is like there's never really a tied up end to a call out. There's more of like a pivot I've seen of like maybe there's a call that's more general about like, have you experienced a wildfire storytelling around experience been, right? That's kind of more of a framing question that you're trying to figure out how you want to frame your storytelling around a specific issue. You get those, and then that helps with the framing, and maybe you follow up with those same people and open up to more and ask a more specific question, like, what's in your go bag? I'm making this up as I go. But like, you know what I mean? It's more of like a pivot of like, okay, we've figured out how to frame our storytelling around this issue from what we've gotten back. Now we want to direct and do reporting on a more particular, specific issue within that. Let's ask another different question. And then I think also maybe there's also community that are hyper-engaged, the folks that are responding really frequently, making sure that they're feeling like they're continuing to be a part of your reporting. So, for example, we have thought of like creating a Facebook group for the folks who are responding to us a lot. So that they can be in conversation with each other, and it may be something that we don't even need to moderate or monitor, but we like give them the idea of starting it for themselves, pivot your storytelling about it, and then you kind of create a space for the communication to continue that's not on you fully. That's like, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was really fortunate to get to kind of stay on that. The month after Ida, I did, you know, basically a weekly short story. And then in the months after that, I worked on some longer. I'll say it is really hard to, you know, continue to get those messages and, you not know what to do with them or know that they're not going to feed directly into a story. But my policy has been to always respond and, you know, to say to people, you know, thank you so much for reaching out to me. This is really helpful for me to have in mind as I continue to report on XYZ thing. And I have found generally that people just appreciate hearing back. I think a lot of people don't expect to hear back. And even though I'm, you know, not always saying, mostly heard people say like, wow, thank you so much for listening to me. Just, I needed to dump that on someone.
I agree. Though I am the wrong person to ask this because I have gone down the lead contamination rabbit hole and I don't think I'm ever coming out. I made myself available to the community. They wanted to organize and partnered up with UC Irvine, like I mentioned. So I made myself available to talk to them about what I found. Like, so to resist the scenes of what I found when I was knocking on doors and testing and hearing back from the community. They wanted to know how much resistance I got from residents. So I was very open, you know, about the process. And in fact, when I returned to keep testing, UC Irvine had students in the community testing as well. So we were sometimes going down the same streets testing at the same homes. And because I had the XRF analyzer and they were taking soil samples, we could, as I did with all my tests in residential homes, gave the results immediately to the residents so that they knew what the lead levels were. So they found that right away. So I would say I use the same approach. I call people, I keep a list. I always tell them, you know, this is part of my ongoing coverage. And there's always many avenues that I'm exploring. I'm working on a piece right now on solutions. And a lot of that does involve the same people that, you know, I was meeting with and sharing the sort of behind-the-scenes information with. So because I was open with new studies or new developments on their end on the work that they're doing. I never promise anything because you never know if you are going to use the information, but I think it's valuable to maintain those relationships because oftentimes there will come a day when you're writing about something that's related to information that they've shared with you.
Yvette has made me think of a couple of things. One is I think when you're starting a project, definitely think about the capacity that's needed to respond to everyone, because it is such an important part of it. And also, community engagement is actually a lot of spreadsheets. And a lot of like color coding and filtering and
Google
Forms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keeping those really organized, because you will come back to them when another issue comes up that is maybe like, you know, concentric circles overlaps with that community. So it's important to keep those stuff really organized.
I was going to say, we have enough time for like maybe one or two more questions depending on how quick we answer. So just give a heads up.
Hi there. I'm Neela Banerjee, the climate editor at NPR. And this is a question for you, Beth, but if the others have ideas, you can too. So regarding collaboration, one of the things that I've been seeing journalists do recently, which I find very inspiring, is working with universities and academia. So Yvette, could you tell us a little bit more about the relationship you built with UC Irvine? And when I was inside climate before NPR, I started to talk to Harvard about something, but there was also like, do we need to raise funding? Do they need to raise funding? So it's not just like, could you tell us not just about the conversations, but whether, you know, grant making is involved, and you know, how and how it all comes together. Maybe this will be a panel at SEJ. Anything you can give us now would be great.
So UC Irvine found their own funding behind the scenes work and steps that I took, and Young, who had done this fabulous Ghost Factory series on contamination from secondary lead smelters. By the time my story published and UC Irvine was reaching out through the community, because this is a coalition of residents and activists through a group called Orange County Environmental Justice. So they already knew that they wanted to do something, but they didn't know what. And they eventually organized and did their own lead testing. I wasn't involved with that, but like I said, when I found out, oh, I'm going to be testing in this neighborhood on this day, their students were going to be out there testing, I didn't mind them coming along to the same doors that I was knocking on, because I had already done it. And so the students were new to it, and so I was perfectly fine having them, you know, dig up their samples in the same yards. So it was just a matter of being open and accessible and sharing, pull away once you've got your story published. But every step of the way with this project, I have been very open to, you know, working with and talking to, like I said, experts like Scott Frickle and Jim Elliott had just had to do an interview, and then that led to these discussions around, well, how can I do this? And Scott connected me with his PhD student to talk about the process that they went through to create the database. So everyone has been, you know, I think for when it comes to knowledge, everyone involved in my lead contamination project has been sort of open and accessible, and it's not, we, like, I don't charge anyone, they don't charge me, it's just a matter of sharing. It made it easier, because I, like I said, I've just learned as I went along and made these connections, but I really do hope that this can be replicated in other cities and towns across the country, because this is a major problem. And I do think
that no worries at all here, and just ask, think about it. It's not pop culture stuff. One word to kind of sum up your feelings about community engagement reporting, and especially after this conversation. I got two words. Oh, well, actually three. Yeah, not enough time. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough time to talk about these things. I think that. That's what's so beautiful about these spaces is that they cultivate larger conversations and the trainings that y'all don't get with. So y'all get one word, I get three. So sorry, y'all.
It was my information about our roles in the community and about what journalism can look like, mm-hmm. which is really exciting to me. Never boring. And it's really impactful, which is like the reason why I'm in this work and what I always want to come back out there.
I would say potential. Many things in the process of doing this environmental justice coverage, but I see so much potential on the community engagement work as well.
Mine is continuing to have an open door with the communities that I'm covering.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much.